listening to TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Now, the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. And today I'm delighted to be able to bring up my friend, Dr. Eric Karlstrom, for a show that we've entitled Ode to Jimmy, which is based upon a song that I'm going to play in a moment. And this will lead us into talking about how the whole 60s thing was a huge psyop. But I'm going to bring Eric up right now. Eric, are you with me?
Yes. Hi, Andy. Good to be back with you again.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you on the show, as always. And should we just go ahead and play the song first, and then that will lead us into the show? It's one of Eric's original songs. What do you reckon, Eric?
Let's just jump right into it, Andy.
Excellent. Right, okay, I'll mute us both, and so there's no interference when I play the song. So do that now. Here we go.
Jimmy was a tall and a skinny, funny-looking kid. He and I was best friends in the second grade. We was always cutting up and giving our favorite teacher fits. But he was in that purple reader all the way. By the time that we grew up to high school age, he'd read most of Steinbeck and was writing poetry. He was playing on the football team, picking folk songs with Ames and Dave and me. Then one summer day, my family moved out west. I had to say goodbye to all my childhood friends. But a few years later, I set out to hitchhiking from Flagstaff back to Arlington. There I found Jimmy looking all pale and weak and drawn. He was singing lead now in a rock and roll band. And I watched him stick a needle in his arm, like his hero, that other Jimmy, was doing then. Then I spent a few days at my favorite aunt and uncle's house, revisiting my second family. Seemed they were all healthy and busy and living well. He was high up in the CIA. A little bit later I heard that Jimmy died, OD'd on the bathroom floor. The word was that he'd really tried to clean up his life and straighten out once more. Well, those crazy times never made much sense to me. The war, the drugs, and all the casualties. It's only looking back now that finally I begin to see things were not at all the way that they appeared to be. It was war for drugs and drugs for war. It was all big profits for those Wall Street banks. It was CIA agents stealing heroin to our soldiers in Vietnam. It was stuffing white powder from Laos into body bags. They could hide 50 pounds inside each man. That's how they shipped the stuff back to America. And how it ended up in Jimmy's veins. Now I wonder if the ones who shipped those drugs ever had to spend a day in jail, or if those Wall Street drug lords ever lost a night of sleep or missed a meal. But it seems the justice system here is broken now, and it's the criminals that rule. But I reckon they'll still have to face a higher law and a judge that can't be bought or fooled. Gazing now into these mysteries, how our lives are wagered, sold and spent. But as these years go drifting by, I sometimes miss my childhood friend. Jimmy was a tall and a skinny, funny-looking kid. He and I was best friends in the second grade. We was always cutting up and giving our teacher fits, but he was in that purple reader all the way.
Amazing. That was absolutely fantastic, Eric. I'm sorry about, I hope it hasn't brought back bad memories, but of course, folks, as you can see, we're going to focus on the CIA, drug trade, etc. Anything else that you'd like to say, Eric? Firstly, with the song, I mean, you were using a guitar for that rather than the banjo, is that correct?
Yeah, that was my first instrument. And of course, I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, 8 miles outside of Washington, D.C. My dad worked for the government with the U.S. Geological Survey, my uncle with the CIA. And our two families were almost, you know, just like one big family growing up. And all my friends, you know, growing up there, you know, baseball, football, kickball. And then about the time we hit junior high school, everybody wanted to learn how to play the guitar because the folk boom had come in and Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul and Mary. And so Ames and, you know, Dave and Jimmy, who were, you know, the four guys that just lived right around my block there. We were all good friends. We'd played all those games before. We just started learning guitar and teaching each other and putting together little, you know, folk bands. And Ames and Jimmy and I put together a little band. And, you know, I remember us getting up on stage. We must have been in junior high school playing Bob Dylan's song, you know, The Times They Are Changing, which indeed they were very, very rapidly in those days. Because, well, I left there and the song pretty much tells the whole story. You know, I mean, there's nothing in the song that's not true, except that Jimmy had read most of Steinbeck and was writing poetry in junior high school, not high school. Wow. But I couldn't get junior high to kind of the meter wouldn't work in the song. So I said high school. But the fact is, he was very precocious. He's a very smart kid. The purple reader, you know, was one of those things you do in school. That was the color of the people that were most advanced. And so he was just, you know, really a smart kid and very imaginative and rebellious. And I left in, our family left in 65, the DC area, went out to Flagstaff, Arizona, because dad took a job there to map the moon, as it turned out, as a geologist. And then, you know, in the next several years, in the time between when we left in 65 and when I hitchhiked back in 69, you know, all the folk music had morphed. The craze now had gone from folk music to folk rock to hard rock to acid rock and everything. And the culture was just being turned upside down with all the Vietnam War stuff. The contrived hippie movement was a psyop to discredit the legitimate protest of the Vietnam War, which totally unjustified. And that can be, you know, read and understood if one picks up a book by David McGowan called Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream, or just go online and listen to David McGowan do some of his YouTube interviews. He's now, unfortunately, passed away fairly young of cancer, but a brilliant guy. And, you know, he figured it out. And the rest of us were all fooled. You know, for years, for 40, 50 years, we thought this was an organic movement. But no, it was part of the importation of sex, drugs, and rock and roll in order to divide and conquer the nation, get the youth and the parents to fight and discredit the youth with the older generation and basically to try, you know, again, to destroy the dang country. The CIA has been at it for so long. It's unbelievable. And then, of course, the personal touch is, here's my good friend who's dying of these, you know, the heroin that's being imported from Vietnam via, you know, well, the CIA, Air America. People have probably heard of this, you know, the Golden Triangle, Laos and whatnot. Bang Pao is the general who was kind of the CIA point man on that, you know, and these were drug lords, basically. And in 1970, a third of the soldiers in Vietnam were hooked on heroin. And of course, all of this is written up. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. White out the CIA drugs in the press, Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, cocaine politics, drugs, armies, and the CIA in Central America, the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia, Alfred McCoy. You know, in other words, if you bother to pick up a book, you know, you can find out about this stuff. And then perhaps one of the best, as most recent, the CIA as organized crime, how illegal operations corrupt America and the world, by Douglas Valentine, 2017. So the poignancy of the song, of course, is that here I've got an uncle, and I don't know what he was doing. Of course, it's all secret. I don't know that he was involved in this particular kind of thing. Probably not. But that organization was overseeing really the destruction of America in the 60s, as it is now. And, you know, I think it's important to revisit the 60s and try to clarify what happened.
Yes. And as a child growing up at that time, because you're sort of late 50s, etc. I mean, I hearken back to that time and I sort of see images from then, and it seemed so much of a nicer world. Families tended to stay together more. But it was the 60s that, as you say, the sex, drugs and rock and roll encouraged free love, which was basically promiscuity. And that was kind of the start of the dissolution of the family, encouraging people to, you know, go off with whomever, whenever, and thus, you know, break up family units. How would you compare, would that be a fair appraisal of comparing life since the 60s with life when you grew up as a child, Eric? Was it a lot more stable when you grew up?
That's my impression for sure. You know, the 50s was very family oriented. You know, the nation certainly had its difficulties, but there was a kind of a common culture. Of course, then along comes the 60s, and then we have all these race riots, many of which turns out were orchestrated by the military, et cetera, and the police, the Red Squads and whatnot. And then we had all of the movements, not only the civil rights movement, which right through the 60s, but of course the feminist movement and the environmental movement and the sex, drugs and rock and roll. So the country was being torn apart. I particularly remember the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention, where there were, you know, agent provocateurs, you know, Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and all these far leftists from Berkeley who were, you know, being beaten up by the Chicago police under Mayor Daley. And then you had William F. Buckley Jr., who's obviously a CIA asset, debating Gore Vidal on TV, you know. And I was ready to just, you know, I was so mad. The country was totally insane. The Vietnam War, you know, killed 58,000 Americans and about 3 million Southeast Asians. You know, the bombing on the Plain of Jars in Laos was greater than all of the saturation bombing of Germany during World War II. You know, the military-industrial complex is the only, they were the only winners of the Vietnam War. Everybody else was a loser. You know, American society lost. Of course, Southeast Asia lost big time. Cultures just torn apart in Cambodia and Laos, et cetera. But the big winners were the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower had warned us about in 1961. So, you know, I mean, the rot had proceeded to such an incredible extent. Most people can't even understand it. But even in the 60s, there was this domestic war between the people who believed in the war in Vietnam, my country right or wrong, America love it or leave it, and the people said, hey, why are we killing 3 million Southeast Asians? You know, they don't know the difference between communism and capitalism. You know, they're farmers and, you know, they're uneducated farmers, you know. And so we really had a very, very the country was just torn in two, and there were a lot of smart people who were, you know, vigorously protesting. And then the hippie movement comes along. Turns out that as we see in the in this incredible book by David McGowan, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, we see that the rock stars out of Laurel Canyon, California, were indeed the sons and daughters of military and intelligence people, for the most part, many, many of them out of the D.C. area where I grew up, and that they were, in fact, spooks. They were spies. They were functionaries, and they were supposed to lead the youth movement. And of course, there was an image that maybe they were protesters, but they weren't. They were taking drugs and you know, having lots of women and getting real famous. And the idea again was to, you know, again lead the opposition, just like Lenin said. You know, the best way to control the opposition is to lead it ourselves. So all this then, you know, is just coming down around the whole society. So think of the '60s as, you know, kind of, you know, you know, taking a compass and then just, you know, spinning the needle as hard as you can. You don't know where it's going to wind up, and you don't know who's going to survive this cultural chaos, induced cultural chaos. Jimmy didn't. He got sucked into the whole rock and roll thing. He thought he was, you know, Mick Jagger. His hero was Jimi Hendrix, and he went the way of Jimi Hendrix. You know, he took too much heroin and died. So, the people at the top, you know, there's a great statement by Douglas Valentine, who wrote the book about Project Phoenix, and this is the guy that wrote the CIA is organized crime. He says, to the CIA, everyone is either cannon fodder or a lab rat. And so that seems to be the case. In other words, they don't really look at the effects on people. They're kind of, you know, intellectual generalizers, sociology types who, you know, well, let's see what's going to happen to society, you know, and move it in this direction. And of course, the CIA always did work for Wall Street and the real financial powers and the people that you've studied, the synagogue of Satan.
Yes, and I'm pleased you brought up that's a very good point. I mean, I was aware of Jim Morrison's father was a Rear Admiral, George Stephen Morrison, and I just looked him up on Wikipedia, funnily enough, and he didn't die that long ago. His father died in November 2008. He was 89 years old. Did he ever come out and admit anything that you're aware of, ever stumble upon it in your research about his son being some sort of agent or what have you? I mean, it's well documented he had serious problems with alcohol and drugs and what have you. But then there's all these rumours surrounding Jim Morrison's death, you know, supposed to have died in that bathtub, and other people say he was murdered and what have you. Any thoughts on that, Eric?
Well, I think that's a good point. You know, the father and the son. Okay. Very, very interesting contrast. Okay. The father is the admiral of the Navy fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin that supposedly was attacked by two, you know, boats of Vietnamese, but it wasn't. It was a fraud. You know, in fact, there were two Gulf of Tonkin incidents and neither one of them, you know, amounted to anything. But of course, the press got a hold of it and said, oh, they attacked our ship. And therefore, you know, President Johnson said, okay, we're going to have to, you know, send in the troops. We'll have a land war now. Well, just to clarify, the CIA had been in there since 1951 and 52, covertly dividing Vietnam into two countries, you know, to destroy it, to control it. The French were being kicked out. They had been the colonial masters in Vietnam for a long time. So the Vietnamese had been at war as long as anybody could remember, either with the French or with the Chinese or whatever. And then the Americans came along in a covert capacity with the CIA. And then in 1964, the war went over. So this was a ruse. This was an operation, this Gulf of Tonkin. It was a fraud. And yet that led to the whole undeclared war of Vietnam, you know, 11 years, 64 to 1975, when we were, you know, kind of tail between our legs. We left there, you know, in defeat, supposedly. But you know, what's the wage of a Vietnamese now? You know, maybe a dollar or two a day. So they've been brought into the capitalistic system as slaves, you know. And of course, that's the point. And, you know, and as well as, you know, control of the resources, it's always the same thing. It's the empire colonial model, which has been around for a long time. But, okay, so there's the father doing the military fraud. And then there's the son, and he's supposedly on the other side doing the hippie thing. And, you know, Pied Piper, Dionysius, you know, great rock star with a lot of charisma, who, by the way, didn't have any musical background before he went into rock and roll and became a star. In other words, there was this huge operation that was, and in fact, these children of these military and intelligence people were cherry picked for these roles, basically on, you know, their looks and, you know, will they comply and whatnot. And a lot of these kids, as it turns out, I think, were mind controlled. Now, MK Ultra came along, you know, 1953 under Alan Dulles and the CIA. And you have, you know, many, many years of experimentation under MK Ultra, MK standing for mind control, on drugs of all kinds. And it's in the 1953 documents, you know, we want to control people's behavior, you know, so that they will do our bidding, even if it conflicts with their self-interest and even their survival instincts. How do you control, you know, human beings? And they experimented with every drug. They started experimenting with LSD right away in its biological form from ergot first, and then they Eli Lilly synthesized LSD, and so they experimented on it for about 10 or 12 years, and determined that it was a psychosis producing war drug, a drug that you would use against the enemy, and then they dumped it on the youth of America during the time when Jim Morrison and those guys were setting up a shop in Laurel Canyon. And all of a sudden, you know, they're getting recording contracts right away. Bars and are just popping up around the L.A. area to support them. And these guys could hardly play their music at all. I mean, all of the early bands, according to David McGowan, you know, like the Byrds and Buffalo Springfield and the Doors and, you know, on and on and on. All these stars that we still listen to, the actual recording music in the studio was played by one band called the Wrecking Crew. And, you know, Glenn Campbell was in that band. And these guys at the beginning could hardly play their instruments. They were chosen for their looks and, you know, their sex appeal, whatever. And then they were pushed. They were puffed, as the, you know, the system does to the people it wants to promote. So it was all a fraud. You know, I mean, the music was pretty good. These people did have talent, and it certainly hooked me in. I mean, I loved that first Byrds record in 1965 or whatever. But it turns out it was the Wrecking Crew playing the instruments, you know. And
what other bands did the Wrecking Crew play the instruments on, for off the top of your head, Eric?
Oh, gosh. The Eagles. I don't know to the extent the Wrecking Crew. Let me just throw out the names that came out of Laurel Canyon there. The Byrds, the Doors, Buffalo Springfield, the Monkees, the Beach Boys, the Turtles, the Eagles, the Flying Burrito Brothers, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, Steppenwolf, CSN, Three Dog Night, and Love, and then such singer-songwriters as Joni Mitchell, Judy Collins, James Taylor, Carole King. They all lived together and jammed together in the bucolic community nestled in the Hollywood Hills. Okay, that's totally, you know, West Coast. But, of course, we were on the East Coast, and, you know, this was the rage. And, of course, then there was the British invasion of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, you know. So we were getting it from both sides. Both all of these, you know, all of these could be looked at as a kind of a Tavistock Institute, Frankfurt School psychological experiment, psychological operation against United States of America and the world, because, you know, this music caught on and went all around the world. So, you know, again, Frankfurt School and Tavistock out of Germany and England were these psychological warfare research institutes that employed such people as Sigmund Freud and his nephew, Edward Bernays, who wrote the book Propaganda, and then Kurt Lewin and the Frankfurt School guys. And a lot of these guys emigrated to the United States when Hitler came into power because they were Jewish. And so, you know, this is how it all played out. So these ideas then, you know, get, get, they, they ferment for a while in books and these figures. Again, we talked about the Frankfurt School a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, this is the now the politically correct movement, the cultural Marxism, all ways to destroy a culture that have been devised by these intellectuals, these sociologists and psychologists and whatnot, Jewish mostly. And all this been played out, you know, and Theodore Adorno, the Jewish music guy who, you know, wanted to, who was part of the Frankfurt School and I believe was affiliated with Tavistock. Certainly, some people claim that he wrote the songs for the Beatles, you know. That's Dr. John Coleman, who wrote a book about the Tavistock Institute and the Committee of 300 and whatnot, a former MI6 and a PhD in political science. So, you know, not a dummy, Dr. John Coleman. And so this is quite possible that, you know, all of these groups then were chosen in order to upset the apple cart, cause a cultural revolution, just like the Frankfurt School wanted to do. So the 60s then becomes this you know, let's just put the marbles in the bottle and just shake it as hard as we can and just drive the whole culture insane. And we've been dealing with the legacy of the 60s ever since. And so have I, you know, because that's basically my life. You know, I grew up, I came of age in the 60s. I was in college in the late 60s. And, you know, I saw how indeed corrupt things are at the highest levels.
In the 60s, when heroin came along, I mean, for example, you know, most people, if they're educated now, would know not to go near heroin because it is just so addictive. And I was actually told, I don't know if this is true, but this was when I was in police training school, that when someone takes their first hit of heroin, every subsequent hit they take for as long as they're addicted is never as good as that first hit, but they're constantly chasing what they had that first hit. But my question is, Eric, is obviously someone like myself would know not to go near that at all because of its addictive nature and the fact that, you know, you'll be selling all your worldly possessions and then probably stealing and anything that you can to get hold of more. But in the 1960s, as it was sort of relatively new, I know it's been around, we can talk about the opium wars in China and also, you know, Chinese hooked on opium, but it was relatively new as a, what would I call it? Well, was it regarded as a recreational drug and not dangerous? I guess that's my question. Were the youth of the 60s actually aware of the danger of getting addicted to heroin, or was it just a case of, oh, it's just like going for a drink? What do you think?
That's a good question. You know, Jimmy, you know, would have been like just about every other kid who, you know, wanted to play guitar and kind of wanted to be a star, you know, and he was looking at his heroes, and there was Mick Jagger and Jimi Hendrix, and that's what they were doing. And he wanted what they had. He wanted to be them. He wanted to be like them. And there must have been, you know, 20 million kids like that in America at that time, you know, that, you know, wanted that. When I went back to Virginia, you know, I got together with some of my old friends and met some new ones, and everybody now was, you know, trying to be Eric Clapton or, you know, playing electric guitar. You know, you get your heroes and then these become your models. And you don't think about, is it addictive? The drugs just kind of came onto the scene like from out of nowhere. People didn't know how to deal with it. People didn't know what they were except for, hey, this is a good time and maybe, you know, we'll party, you know, and this is what our heroes do. People certainly didn't know about the effects of LSD, which is hallucinogenic. So, you know, it changed everything. And I think that from what I understand, you know, all that's still with us in America. We now have a marijuana boom going on, you know, in Colorado because we've legalized recreational use of marijuana. And right in my little hometown of Crestone, we've got a land rush, people coming in to do quote unquote agriculture, meaning they want to, you know, grow the crop that will pay them the best, which is, from an economic viewpoint, it makes sense. And then, of course, it's a cultural lifestyle thing, too. So, but see, as a professor, I would have noticed that the students that came to me, you know, maybe 18, 19, 20 years old, who had, you know, started smoking marijuana or doing drugs when they were 14, 15. These kids never really learned how to read because the brain is developing at those ages. And, you know, drugs will just really make it difficult for make it impossible for the brain to develop in a normal way. And those kids will be handicapped intellectually for the rest of their lives. And I've seen that so many times. A little bit of marijuana here and there is not going to hurt you. But if it becomes part of your lifestyle, even marijuana makes you stupid, you know. And these other drugs are much more dangerous. I mean, heroin will kill certain individuals that they just can't take it. And other individuals, see, you know, like Mick Jagger, you know, probably been doing heroin, you know, for, gosh, since then. And his constitution, for whatever reason, he's and his Keith Richards, those guys, for whatever reason, are physiologically just able to stand it.
Well, it's funny with Mick Jagger because not a lot of people know this, but this is the background to Mick Jagger. He left school in 1961 after passing 7 O levels and 3 A levels. Jagger continued to study business on a government grant as an undergraduate student at the London School of Economics and had seriously considered becoming either a journalist or a politician. So, I mean, this guy was no idiot. And as you said, these people were singled out for a role from day one. And I firmly believe, I mean, I used to think, for example, when Michael Jackson, you know, his album Thriller came out and it became like the best-selling album ever type of thing in, what was it, 1982, I believe. You just knew that, you know, his next album couldn't have been an off-the-wall type of, you know, avant-garde type of music because he'd become the goose that made the golden egg for that record company. And I remember when I was younger thinking they just would not let that guy write a song that they hadn't, you know, tested to know that it would sell, etc., etc. So essentially you become the property of the record company. And when you see that the music is designed to influence the youth, and then we see, I mean, who was the, we had all these, when rap started off, which I absolutely loathe, to be honest. But it was a black thing that started off. But then who was the big band in America that made it accessible to white people? It was the Beastie Boys. And when you look at the Beastie Boys, they were all Jewish. What are your thoughts on the fact that, as I say, someone like Jackson, very unlikely he wrote all his own stuff. It was probably written by several decent writers, and to make sure that they still got the money, and also the way that they shape the music system now into rap, which has morphed into basically encouraging violence and all sorts of depravity in their lyrics. Sorry to go around the moon with that, Eric, but any thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, I think just listening to one of David McGowan's YouTube interviews again last night, just to refresh my mind on these things, you know, he really got down into the nitty gritty details, you know, behind the scenes. You know, who was the manager of, you know, the Doors, and who was the manager of Jimi Hendrix? Look at these guys, look at their connections, and you'll find a lot of Jews, and you'll find a lot of criminals, and you'll find a lot of intelligence people that are actually manipulating these stars and often stealing from them blind, you know, just taking advantage of them. There is a whole, you know, gigantic system, which I think you probably know as well as I do, has got roots in Satanism, behind this popular music thing, especially the rock and roll, and a lot of crime, and you know, on and on and on. So yeah, it you know, the devil is then in the details. You know, what we see is the, you know, Michael Jackson, he's up there, he did a song, and, you know, Jim Morrison wrote this song, and the Beatles did that song. But who's behind it? You know, who's putting these people forward? Who's making the money? Who's, you know, what's the agenda being pushed? And I think, you know, fortunately now people are exposing that kind of thing, and that's what we need to focus on.
Yes, and I mean, as the listeners will know, a Dr. Eric Karlstrom show is always, you provide so much information that I kind of have to dance around back and forth, Eric. I hope you forgive me, because there's so many areas that I want to cover. And one of them, are you familiar? Have you ever seen the film Jacob's Ladder at all?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, I won't go into that, but essentially all it is it's a film, it really is worth watching. It's got Tim Robbins in the lead role, and it's centred around a Vietnam War. And there's it's about a group of soldiers that get together, and they're all suffering after the war, and it's because they were put on these drugs and what have you. And then it all ends up, and at the end of the film, it goes back to the war, and you don't know if essentially what you saw through the film was what happened and these soldiers meeting up, or in fact, this was all their individual hallucinations because they were given these drugs before they died. And it really is one of those weird films that, like, blows you away. It's well worth a watch. But you mentioned earlier about, obviously, the LSD. I remember seeing these films that got out, black and white films, and they put the soldiers on LSD and they were testing them, and the soldiers didn't know, and they were getting them to run around and stuff like that. You made the interesting comment that the CIA regards people as either cannon fodder or basically to be killed. And so it's interesting when you look at something like the Vietnam War, where the soldiers were the cannon fodder and they were bringing the drugs home in their bodies to kill off the youth of America and corrupt the youth of America. So to my mind, we wind forward to say 9/11, which you're an expert on. And I remember at the time there was a lot of these so-called conspiracy theorists that were pushing that idea. You'll probably remember the idea of the gas pipeline. That's what the Afghanistan war was really about. And of course, what it was really about was the previous year, the Taliban had destroyed all the opium crop in that country. And I believe that the opium crop out of that country resulted in 80 to 90% of the world's opium production. So it was extremely important that the CIA have it for their heroin, etc. But when we were told by the authorities that these Taliban, you know, they were backward people, went round on donkeys and what have you, but they were able to destroy all the opium crop. However, when the Americans and the British went in after so-called 9/11 or something to get Osama bin Laden, the following year we had a bigger opium crop than ever. And so they're trying to tell us in one breath that these people, you know, they've got no military hardware or anything like that. And then in the same breath, they're saying that they can't control the production of the opium, even though the US and Britain have got all these military aircraft, etc., where they could essentially just, you know, firebomb a whole opium field and raise it to the ground. These people, Eric, they just give the game away so easily. They're so transparent. What are your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, 96% I've read of the world's, you know, opium heroin comes from the Golden Crescent now, you know, in Afghanistan. And yeah, there's the United States military, you know, guarding that area and making sure the production goes along. And the Taliban, as you say, had actually, you know, destroyed it pretty much, the production. So they were trying to clean up the country. But now, obviously, the country is back in the hands of the drug lords and the warring drug lords and the United States military. And of course, it also has to do with the great game, which is, you know, this Halford Mackinder idea of, you know, controlling Eurasia. Who controls Eurasia controls, you know, the world, 2/3 of the world's population, 2/3 of the world's resources. And eventually, you know, pushing China and Russia back so that they don't, you know, control Eurasia. But yeah, you know, the CIA, according to, and of course the British, the Opium Wars, you know, that all goes back into the 19th century. There's a book by Lyndon LaRouche called Dope Incorporated, which really, you know, kind of lays it at the door of the British. But if you read the Douglas Valentine's book, CIA's Organized Crime, he lays it at the door of the CIA. And of course, they're all, you know, mobbed up, the MI6 and the CIA. They're doing the bidding of the CFR and the, you know, the British equivalent, which is the Royal Institute of International Affairs and blah, 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 blah. But according to Douglas Valentine, the CIA controls the world's drug trade, and that's all of the syndicates of the Mexican and all Central American, and they have to, according to their thinking, because this produces some $600 billion a year of liquid cash, which can be laundered through the banks and the corporations. Michael Rupert was good on this. He's got a couple of good videos and books on this. And that's money that, people can put down on the table and get results. Other money might be, strings attached. But this is new money to the system every year. $600 billion is the figure I've heard. It may be different now. The drug trade, the illegal drug trade is a huge part of the world's economy. And every major bank launders that money. This is a system which is very, very, very deeply embedded, and just don't see the people like Jimmy who are the casualties of this. I don't see the future he never had, the destruction of his family and his community, that sort of thing. That's not on their radar. It's just all dollars and cents apparently to these people.
Well, how old was Jimmy when he died?
About 19 or 20, back in 1969 or 70.
So, let's say his parents at that time would be about, say, 50, just on average. They'll probably live for another, 25, 30 years. And it's nothing worse than living every day knowing that you lost a child.
Oh, his mother, worked at Sears, and she just sacrificed everything for him, and his older brother. But Jimmy was kind of the special one. And the father was a fundamentalist Christian preacher who was there and not there and there and not there and older than most fathers at that point. But, maybe suffering some dementia. But, it must have just crushed the mother, because she had sacrificed everything for him. And I when I saw him shooting it in his veins, heroin, that is, it was in his own bedroom in his own house, so it was going on right under their noses. And I'm told the story by my other friend Ames that the story was that after Jimmy died, his father, who was already kind of in dementia, was kind of walking around the streets and yelling, "Something's wrong with Jimmy, something's wrong with Jimmy." It's like he just hadn't registered even to him that his son died. We're talking, just tragic stuff going on all over America and the world from these drugs, So this is really dark. This is the Satanism. And that's, just one part of it, of course. But they don't care, how many lives are wrecked. I think they get off on it, I think they kind of, makes their day or something. That's the hardest part for me to wrap my mind around, It's like, why people, don't put an end to these systems, pedophilia, mind control, drugs, sex trafficking, child trafficking. This is the underbelly of our society, which is very lucrative for these people. Why don't the rest of us, why can't the rest of us clean this up?
Yes. And another couple of points I just wanted to raise is, of course, when we go back to the opium wars in China, it was essentially the Sassoon family, which was a branch of the Rothschild family. And they got all of China hooked on drugs. And the Opium Wars were basically China saying, "We want you to stop, making drug addicts of our people." And there was a war over it because they wanted to keep selling them drugs. And they were doing this in conjunction with the British royal family at the time. And a guest I've had on my show before has made the point, if they were making all that money out of the drug trade now, do you honestly think that they've given up their role in the drug trade? And the other point that I'd like to raise, and you brought this guy up, and it's never been mentioned on my show, and I've never mentioned him, and it was one of the first books I ever bought, Mike Rupert. I remember he was one of the earliest presentations. There was that presentation that you could see on the internet, years and years ago. I think he brought it out about 2002, 2003, where he gave that speech to, I think, a college or something about 9/11. But he never looked at the Jewish angle. And then he also, because I got his book, Crossing the Rubicon, he was pushing peak oil all the time, which I don't think is something that I necessarily agree with. But he still was putting out, you know, a lot of work, which was good. I think he had a newsletter. And of course, I think it was only 2-3 years ago, wasn't it, that he allegedly took his own life. I think people around him said that they believed it was genuine, he wasn't suicided. How closely did you follow the work of Mike Rupert? And if so, Eric, is there anything else that you'd like to add to that?
Well, I did follow Mike Rupert. He was one of the smart, credible people that was, you know, questioning the war, 9/11 and the subsequent wars. He did get it, you know, on a number of these 9/11 truth conferences that I attended, and he had been with LAPD. He'd been courted by the CIA. His parents were in intelligence. He was a Mensa, meaning very, very high IQ. And he was basically at heart a detective. So he looked at the whole 9/11 thing as a crime. And, he started to uncover these military drills that were going on the same day, which kind of lays the whole thing right back in the lap of the Air Force and the military that is these drills then, of course, flipped live. So he was onto that early. He did a lot on the drug trade, did a lot on the history of the CIA and its ties with Wall Street. And interestingly enough, he had a very, apparently, a difficult life. His newsletter was From the Wilderness.
That's it.
And it was well titled because he was kind of moving around the world trying to, stay alive. He was in Venezuela for a while and he came and lived pretty much near where I live in Southern Colorado, although I never met him. Supposedly, he went down to the local bar here and got to know some of the local people. But then out in California, he is where he supposedly committed suicide. And I don't know if that was a suicide or whether that was a murder or what. But he had big blind spots. He thought it was all for peak oil, and I think he's wrong. He ignored the Jewish angle. So it's hard to know when you get into this level of kind of intelligence type of who's telling the truth, who's mixing information and disinformation intentionally to mislead, or who's doing it because they don't know, and all of us have to sort that out almost on a daily basis, and it's challenging, and it's sometimes not you can't even do it sometimes.
Well, it's interesting that you made the point that you heard that he was seen around the local bar, because I remember the presentation that I saw in which he made the point of saying that he was an alcoholic and he hadn't had a drink for X number of years. So I don't know if that means that he returned to it before he died. Obviously, we can only speculate. But that is an interesting point. And the other thing I'd like to just mention, Eric, is we've got about 8 minutes left. So if there's any information that you've put together for today that you haven't got out yet, please go ahead and do so.
Okay, Andy. Well, thanks so much for the opportunity here. It's kind of, let me just mention, this was a very difficult song to write. I wrote it in 2003. I started writing songs back in the 60s when everybody else was, everybody was playing guitar back in those days, and it was the cool thing to do. And I was pretty good at it because I've got a lot of musical genes in my family history. so your heroes then are the people who are, getting the airplay on the radio or TV or whatever. But writing this song took a long time to get the perspective and to get the words together. I guess we should kind of conclude as we started, like, focusing on the song a little bit. Jimmy being a bright kid who was a little bit rebellious and who was very precocious, was writing good poetry in the ninth grade. Within just a few years, he was, went right down the toilet in a good old fashioned middle class American community. He just destroyed himself. I'm sure this is going on a lot in America now because young people might not have, that much hope, and the drugs are there, so a certain percentage are going to be, a little bit on the edge and experiment and, And all I can say is, you know, please don't destroy your lives, because your lives are precious, you know, and you are, you know, you're inheritor of a tremendous culture and it was a tremendous culture, you know. And of course, if the Christian worldview would say that, you know, that, you know, you're the crown of God's creation. So if you start to look in the bigger picture, which is that your body really isn't your own, that, you know, your creation, you're not the boss, you're not the creator, you're the creation, get in line with the rules of the universe as put forth by the creator, you know, you're going to have a little better chance of not going down those very destructive roads. I'm sure that my little cautionary sermon here is not going to probably change too many people's fate, but this is the kind of thing that you, this kind of perspective you learn from watching your friends self-destruct. And of course, in my university, my college, all of a sudden people were, you know, experimenting with drugs, and I watched people wreck their minds, kill themselves, and so there, it's a very, very dangerous thing to be doing, and it breaks my heart to see so much of it.
Yes, and one thing that I just thought of, Eric, is, isn't it interesting that we talk about the 60s and, you know, we had all this youth rebelling against their parents, and their parents stood for morals and Christian values and the family, and these kids were, you know, basically encouraged to indulge in drugs and immorality with multiple sexual partners, etc., and, you know, growing their hair long rather than, you know, keeping themselves smart, etc. And now we wind forward to the current time, 2017, and we've had this movement called the alt-right come along. Now, I think that there are some genuine people there, but I think that there are a lot of charlatans that are put there by the media that they tell us are leaders, and they seem to come out of nowhere with no history. But certainly some of the alt-right, they promote nationalism, and they promote you know, not mixing with other races, etc., sexually. They promote a lifestyle that isn't immoral. They don't go as far as Christianity. I think a lot of them are atheistic. But the shoe's now on the other foot. You've got this youth movement rebelling against the parents that go in for the liberalism and the drugs and the immorality, and the youth, or certainly a proportion of them, are now going back to this old way of life. Do you see any encouragement out of that, that maybe our young people are starting to wake up and realise the lifestyle that we started adopting some 50 years ago is wrong, and they're going to turn to more traditional values? Or do you think that this is just a smokescreen, Eric?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I retired from teaching in 2011. There were an awful lot of tattoos and cell phones. You know, I really can't say, you know, it's too big a question for my, you know, my own observations. America, you know, I mean, the world is just too big a place. I can hope that, certainly we can hope that, but, I don't know. I'll throw it back to you. Do you see a positive trend there, Andy?
Well, it's always really difficult because, you know, what I find is I don't know what impact, you know, my work and your work and, you know, the work of, I mean, let's take something like the Daily Stormer, for example, and like it or hate it, they literally get chased all around the world. They get one website, one minute they're in, I think they were in Iceland, then they were in Anguilla, and then they were in Western Samoa, and they just keep getting these domains and keep getting them shut down, having to go to the dark web. And my point being is that there's obviously, there's something about them that are attracting a large enough group of people that the Jewish controllers want to shut them up. And in the same way, like ourselves, I mean, I lost a YouTube a few weeks ago, and it was my biggest, most popular YouTube, and not really that. I mean, it's over 100,000 views, which isn't that much in, you know, you hear about these alternative people that get, you know, hundreds of thousands of views. But obviously there was something in there. It was basically the first part of the Synagogue of Satan, so I don't know why they were so bothered about that. They left the other parts up there, but they've had nowhere near as many views. I think the next one's about 20,000. So essentially, I don't know. I think that they're scared of us. The fact that they control 96% of the world's media and they're trying to shut down elements of the remaining 4%. If we were not a threat, they wouldn't be doing this, would they?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked about, you know, gang stalking, organized gang stalking and electronic harassment, these kinds of things. You know, and it reminds me of, I think there's something in the protocols about, you know, and our Messiah will come without opposition. I think they're very, very concerned about removing all the opposition or potential opposition, which of course means they're targeting Christians and the Christian churches, because they want their Messiah, which Christians would regard, I think, as the Antichrist, to come in and take over the world, be their leader and usher in the Jewish universal empire, Jewish utopia, etc. We're very close to the point where the war then is between this elite and the opposition. And the opposition is in all countries. And it's the good people who are, you know, can still have free will and some, you know, moral values and don't want to play along with this satanic system. I think they're coming down pretty hard on these truth seekers, truth tellers, dissidents, whistleblowers, people of conscience, et cetera. And they have now the tools of the, you know, electronic weapons, et cetera, and what we talked about with the organized stalking. So we're really, in a system which is very, very draconian and evil if you're on the wrong side of it. And that is to say, if you're standing up for truth and some values.
Thank you very much, Eric. We're out of time today. Eric and I will be back. We've already got another show scheduled, so we'll be back in a few weeks. Tomorrow, it's Paul English. I want to thank everyone for listening, and bye for now.
You have been listening to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show on TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. In an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.